Coming up on this week's episode of Mars Ready Now, China launched and landed an experimental reusable spacecraft, Rocket Labs has now launched 55 satellites, and we discussed the mental fortitude involved in being Mars Ready Now.
Mars Ready Now is a manifesto. The new space race is real. People are hyped. But the terrible truth is that only a small fraction will ever actually know what it's like to travel beyond Earth. Most of those who wonder will never find out. We do not want to miss out on humanity's greatest adventure. When the call goes out, whenever that may be, we do not want to be unprepared. I'm your host, James Coombs. I'm joined by my good friend, Soren Childs, and this is Mars Ready Now. Hello and welcome to Mars Ready Now, Episode 5, the podcast that asks the question, who among us are ready to go to space? It is September the 12th, 2020. We're going to start off with the news. And remember, we are not experts analyzing the news. Rather, we are enthusiasts exploring it with a spirit of adventure. So let's start exploring. Soren.
All right, well, in deference to the fact that I'm not supposed to just be reading these things, I did go and look at some of these headlines ahead of time. After all, how am I supposed to write these introductions? But
it's fair enough.
I think it's been a bit of a slow news week. Because the top story I'm seeing is the moon's rusty.
The moon's rusty.
Cox shotgun and gets back into the capsule. Moon's rusty.
Inside jokes. How can the moon be rusty? There's no air up, or there's very little air up there.
Well, let's see here. And
well, presumably that's why it's news.
Yes. So they actually say the moon has rusty regions, according to the researchers behind a puzzling new finding. The moon is not an optimal place for rust to appear, but the lunar rust might be caused by Earth's atmosphere.
What?
Let's see here. This is actually an entire week old.
220,000 kilometers distance. Okay, so how exactly does the fact that it's a week old, I don't think we care. We're too hooked on this now. How exactly does Earth's atmosphere affect iron on the moon?
That's a good question. I'm going to just...
While you're looking at that, I've got a... You look into that. I've got a sort of aha moment of my own that I'm sitting here feeling a little bit... not smug, but mildly interested about. NASA challenges companies to mine lunar soil, which is an interesting one that I've got here. And do you remember we had that conversation a little while ago, not on the podcast, just between you and I, when we were discussing all of the possible businesses and companies that could be started to do with space and all of the facilities that are going to be required for a space industry that just simply haven't yet been developed on Earth. And you remember that one of them that I mentioned was the idea of lunar regolith development, because everyone on Earth who wants to develop stuff for the moon is going to need to test their stuff first before they send it there. So you need stuff to test it with.
Yes. So I take it you found a lunar regolith substitute manufacturer.
No, I have not. What I have found is this report, which basically says that NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said on Thursday it could lead to the mining of lunar soil could lead to companies. I am saying this incorrectly. NASA wants to buy lunar soil commercially, Bryanstein said on Thursday in a virtual presentation at the Secure World Foundation's Space Sustainability Summit. So we want a company to go to the moon, extract some lunar soil, and then NASA can take possession of it. That sounded far more sinister than it needed to. I assume there's just been words left out there.
James, are you choosing the headlines that you know for certain will trigger me? Is that what here?
No. It is merely the journalist deciding to leave out some boring words, I believe. We are buying the regolith, but we're doing it really to demonstrate that it can be done, that the resources extracted from the moon are in fact owned by the people who invest their sweat and their treasure and their equity into that effort, Bryanstein says. That should be slightly less triggering for you. That should be more on the yes sort of scale, I imagine.
Yes. I've got to say, I think we're on the right track with that part of it, but
NASA wants to buy it, is the point.
Yeah.
And NASA, I was actually incorrect.
And that to me just sounds like they're becoming more and more like Aperture Science by the day.
I was incorrect, however, in my immediate assumption that I leapt to when I said that NASA wants people to create lunar regolith. That is not, in fact, the case. NASA is apparently suggesting that they might be interested in contracting somebody to go and grab some lunar soil and bring it back for them, which I think would be a really good thing. That's basically them saying, well, we want to kickstart the capability for somebody to do lunar mining, because that's basically what that is, right?
Right. Speaking of mining in space, I wanted to amend my comment from the speculation street of 2 weeks ago, where I talked about the need for something as involved as a von Neumann probe just to get spaceborne industry off the ground. Har har.
Okay.
What I was really trying to get at is this idea that you don't need a fully self-replicating individual platform, but you do need to be able to do most of the manufacturing for the construction of the equipment in space. So it's not a matter of an entire self-replicating individual standalone probe. It's we have to have all the capabilities for mineral extraction and refining and machining or shaping out there in orbit, because the cost of moving the equipment up and then retrieving the materials coming back down, I expect that would be the most prohibitively expensive leg of the journey.
Yeah, no, I can completely get behind that as a statement. Sounds very
reasonable. With regards to lunar iron and why it might be rusty, it's looking here from this enhanced image posted from someone over at the NASA in partnership with the University of Hawaii. It's looking like the rust they were talking about is mostly hematite, specifically hematite deposits in the moon's polar regions.
Is that a specific type of iron, or type of iron? I mean, what is hematite? Do you know?
Bloodstones.
Bloodstones. Okay. I've never played. Hang on, is that from Dark Souls?
No, I was thinking Welcome to Night Vale, but
okay.
Ritual sacrifices must be conducted inside of your bloodstone circles. City Council is the only licensed dealer of bloodstones.
Okay.
But no, hematite is I think it's a very iron-rich ore, essentially, but
okay, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, it sometimes gets called bloodstone because of its distinct red color. Once again, Soren Childs is a computer scientist, not a geologist. So
you need to get your friend
in your own research.
Yeah.
However, this is looking like the article is backing up my my own guess on why this is, and that is that the rusty portions of the moon, the hematite-rich sections, are at the poles, specifically because that is where we're expecting to find the remaining deposits of water ice in the deep shadowed craters. Excuse me. So there's where you get the oxygen to rust the iron on the moon. You have a... Well, my guess would be that there's a great big chunk of water ice down there that is being irradiated along with everything else on the moon, and that the lunar regolith, which I seem to recall is pretty iron rich to begin with, is right there next to it. So
that makes sense.
Give the moon some geological time scales to work with, and that sounds like a recipe for rust to me.
Yeah,
but does. That's quite enough of the moon being rusted and quite enough of the other main story from 2 days ago being that there's wildfires all up and down the west.
We'll get to that soon United enough.
States and yeah. Looking out my window just now, it's the
You're not having to run for it, are you?
Has been transplanted from Mordor. So we cannot see the sky, and we cannot see more than 100 meters from the window.
Wonderful.
Let me see if I can find something more.
Well, hang on a minute. I think on the... We are trying, and sometimes failing, as a general rule, to make sure that we actually do talk about the news item that we include in the introduction. We have not always been successful at this, but I would like this week for us to actually succeed in this. So go for it.
Yeah, I need to actually find the darn thing.
Okay, well, I've got the article up here from my website. Well, not my website, from spaceflightnow.com. China tests experimental reusable spacecraft shrouded in mystery.
Yeah. Sorry.
A mysterious space vehicle described by Chinese state media as an experimental reusable spacecraft completed a two-day flight in low Earth orbit Sunday. And because it is a mysterious object, the article does not include any pictures of it. They merely have a picture of China's Long March 2F rocket instead. So, yeah. Let's see, the spacecraft took up on... Oh, sorry, my bad. It is a reusable spacecraft, but it is not a reusable launch vehicle. The spacecraft took up on... took off on top of... That's a tongue twister for you. A Long March 2F rocket on Friday from the Jiuquan launch base in the Gobi Desert of northwestern China, according to a statement by the China Aerospace Science Technology Corp, blah, blah, blah. So it's actually more akin to the DARPA secret space plane thing that's been orbiting Earth for quite a while and occasionally goes back up there that DARPA does tests with, I'm guessing. Of course, we have pictures of that. We have no pictures at all of this. Oh, here we go. Yes, without divulging specifics about the reusable test spacecraft, a military source told the South China Morning Post, a Hong Kong newspaper, that maybe you can take a look at the USX-37B, which is what I talked about just now. Nevertheless, the secret nature of the spacecraft and its mission, even by Chinese standards, points to a military purpose. Some analysts compared the spacecraft, assuming it to be a winged vehicle, to the U.S. Air Force reusable X-37B space plane. Yes. So that is what it's looking like. Do you have anything else on your article?
No, I don't have anything else worth taking up our time talking about the moon being rusty.
And, okay, well, in that case, I'm going to
the satellite monitor of California wildfires from space is just depressing.
Well, I guess that's the a benefit and a curse of space. You get really good imagery of disasters that are happening.
Yeah.
I've got a few. I'd like to try doing a quick wrap up of various other news articles just by reading off the headlines.
Alrighty then.
Okay, here we go. Stacking of next Atlas V rocket begins at Cape Canaveral. So that's the thing. After a second hop, SpaceX prepares for the next phase of Starship testing. Whatever that is. I mean, oh, that's right. The SpaceX brought out their new the new Raptor engine that was optimized for space instead of for land-based stuff. It's got a much bigger nozzle because, you yes. know, the whole no pressure in space causing a plume out of the rocket that is far wider, and so you need a bigger nozzle to contain it. China launches another Geofen Earth observation satellite. And coronavirus delays push back the launch of the next Landsat to September 2020. Mwah, mwah. But there. Yeah. As you said before, it's a bit of a slow news week.
Yep.
I feel like we could say more about the news, but I also feel that if we did say more about the news, it would just be speculation. And there we go. Coming off of the news, since it's a reasonably slow news week, we're just going to go straight into Speculation Street. The segment where we take one article, project, company, or anything else we might find and then speculate wildly on what it might mean for the near-term future of humans in space. And this week's target is, and I'm surprised that we didn't actually talk about this in the news because they have had some news recently, perhaps not exactly in the last week, which is why our scans didn't spot it, Rocket Labs and their photon bus.
Oh,
I've had these guys on my radar for quite a while now, so let's see what's what.
Lead us in with why you have chosen to speculate about this.
Okay, well, Rocket Labs is one of a very large number of companies who are moving into the industry, the space, the speculative entrepreneurial venture of small sat launches to orbit. It was always believed that you had these really large companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, and that they would take care of the really large stuff. And then there would be this small like niche industry where people who didn't have as much funding could get in on the ground floor and do launches for much smaller satellite providers because of the ever shrinking size that satellites can be. Obviously, back in the day, satellites were huge things that required really large really large launch vehicles to get into orbit. Now, the amount of technology and capability that can be packed into a CubeSat, which is a 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter satellite, or a number of variations on a CubeSat, so you can have like a 1U CubeSat, which is just one, or a 2U or a 3U. That capability is just so much more. And Rocket Lab is, I want to say it's the only one. I don't think it actually is, though, because I think Virgin Orbit can also do this capability. But they are one of the only launch providers of the literal over 100 that are out there currently working on this stuff that can actually put a payload into orbit. They have a very unique set up a very unique philosophy. They're not American. They're based out of New Zealand. Their rocket is called the Electron, and it is a fully electric rocket, apart from obviously the fuel that comes out of it. But apart from the fuel that comes out of it, the rest of it is fully electric, which is very interesting. And they've been piggybacking on quite a lot of the benefits that come from increasingly sophisticated battery technology and electronics and all this other kind of stuff. And they recently have had some interesting announcements to do with standardization of satellite missions. And I thought it would be interesting to take a look at that standardization and speculate on what it might mean for the industry and for future capability. So there we go. Why don't you have a look and tell me what you think of these chaps?
Well, I was going to say that looking at the page on Rocket Lab's website, specifically for their Photon system, they've got both a low Earth orbit configuration and an interplanetary configuration, which sounds to me like it could very well be a... They've actually got a the possibility of sending things to the moon.
And Mars as well, I believe.
Yep, it interplanetary is one of the capabilities they're talking about here. So we might see an effort to... Yeah, here's some speculation for you. I don't think it is entirely unreasonable to assume that one of these interplanetary configured Photon vehicles might not be basically the orbiter for a unmanned lunar regolith retrieval mission.
Ooh, that's an interesting idea.
Because basically,
you'd need a very, very small payload to do that, though. What's the payload size for the lunar missions that this thing's capable of putting out?
Let's see here.
Incidentally, I very much approve of this marketing that they have here, and I think you made a joke about this when we were talking about this before the show. Bespoke satellites, common products.
Yes, and it looks like they're. Payload weight for beyond low Earth orbit or interplanetary is less than 40 kilograms. I'm not really sure what they're trying to convey here. The closed side of the triangle is towards the 40 kilograms, so I'm guessing they're meaning more than 40 kilograms.
Maybe a little bit over, just about 40 kilograms, maybe 40, like 40 and a bit. They just wanted a big round number. For those of you, allow me just to quickly clarify exactly what the Photon system is. So the idea behind the Photon system is that Rocket Lab have developed a whole bunch of standardized satellite parts. So we've got things like the composite structure of the satellites. We've got things like propulsion so that you can do station keeping or presumably also just interplanetary and interlunar travel. They've got reaction wheels, which are a type of device that is used to adjust the angle that a satellite is currently pointing towards. Avionics, solar arrays, and star trackers. And the idea is that a company will come to Rocket Lab and say, we've got a mission, and Rocket Labs will be able to say, well, okay, we've got all this standardized infrastructure which integrates into the rocket that goes up there. It provides things like the power and various other... It provides the power. Was there any... What else did it provide? I know there was other stuff as well. Well, anyway, the bus provides a whole bunch of standardized features for the mission, and this will leave the customer far more time and resources available to focus on the things that are specifically unique to their mission, rather than on reinventing the wheel every single time you send up a new satellite. I would like to point out that there are, in fact, a number of companies that do standardized satellite parts. So the idea of a of a standardized library of satellite parts is not new. I know of a number of companies in the United Kingdom, for example, Surrey Satellite Solutions, I think they're called, for example. I know of this company, and they do something very similar and have done for a very long time. This is the first time that we have seen this library of satellite components being offered as a built-in service to an orbital class rocket, so that the components just automatically are constructed into the rocket as well. Although presumably not to the reusable bit, because another thing about Rocket Lab is they are trying to make their rocket reusable. So not that bit, presumably. And here's my bit of speculation. My speculation is that as more and more parts of rocket missions and satellite missions, and potentially even lunar and Mars-related missions, become more and more standardized and become more and more, you know, off the shelf, we will see more startups developing that don't need to focus on that stuff. And because they don't need to focus on that stuff, they can focus on the other more interesting problems of a satellite mission. And this means that a satellite needs fewer resources, right? It needs less people. It needs less expertise and all sorts of stuff like this. And this is important because
James. It's that we're finally starting to see a greater degree of a division of labor in the space industry. People are specializing. We've got Rocket Labs people going and building their launch platform and their specialized part or their standardized parts, so that specialists focused on mission particular payloads can devote a greater amount of their time to making sure that their payload is going to meet or exceed an ever more sensitive range of mission parameters.
Yes. Yeah, I would completely agree. And my thinking is that what this does is it reduces the cost of entry for startups to engage in space-related activities, particularly in interlunar and interplanetary ones, which has always been a bit, you know, iffy. I mean, we've had one private mission to the moon, and that was by an Israeli nonprofit company, which landed a probe on the moon last year. I can't remember the name, so please don't shoot me on that. But there has been one private mission that was privately funded to a body that is not around Earth. Just one. With this, we could see more of them, which is good which is just good in general. It also, and the way it does this is by lowering the barrier to entry for those companies. And by lowering the barrier to entry, it means that these startups require less financing and less funding. And because these startups require less financing and less funding, this decreases the risk for investors who are investing in new space companies. And this is all encouraging for the entrepreneurial space segment. So that's my speculation. I'd like to see that. I'd be interested to know exactly when we see the first Rocket Labs interplanetary, or actually, can you say, is interlunar a word? I mean, what would you call going to the moon?
Using lunar, I think they're just using lunar in these discussions.
Okay, just lunar missions. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. I mean, presumably interlunar would be like we're around Saturn and we're going from Deimos to Phobos, that's the moon, isn't it?
That's Mars.
Yeah. Sorry, that's Mars. Yeah, sorry. The moon. What am I on? I swear, yeah. You're right. That's around Mars. So interlunar would be we're going from Deimos to Phobos around the orbit of Mars. That would be interlunar. So yeah. But anyway, this is all very interesting. But at the same time, until we know more about it, this is also just speculation. Yes, that was Speculation Street. And just like that, we move into T-Minus Unknown. We're really moving together we're really moving forward at quite a clip this week. Last week, we went over an hour, actually. I think this week we are going to be well under an hour. So,
that's what we get for having a slow news week.
Yeah, true. Anyway, just like that, we move into T-Minus Unknown, in which we talk specifically about being Mars ready now, whether this is something we're doing ourselves to prepare for humanity's future in space, or thoughts we've had about the general principles, so that if and when the time comes, we're not all massively disappointed. We've already got one of our manifesto pillars down, and it's about time we discussed another, the spirit of adventure.
Yes. And
I believe that you, Soren, are now living in a moderately adventurous part of the world.
I wouldn't characterize the sky being covered in smoke as being particularly adventurous, especially considering that it has really put a kink in my ability to go running. But
what's happened to the sky?
The forest fires all up and down the west coast of this continent have made everything smoky. Right. James.
Okay, yes.
I'm pretty sure I mentioned that earlier in this podcast episode, in fact, that I couldn't...
Sure, but some people might be listening to this 6 months from now and have completely forgotten everything about what's happening. So, you know, I just thought it'd be a good idea to bring that up.
Okay, well, for those of you who aren't living in 2020 anymore, congratulations.
Yes, this is a one to remember, but this is before 2021 turns into like the absolute worst thing ever.
And for those of you who don't recall, during the early days of September 2020, the entire west coast of the United States caught fire. We had some truly horrific images, such as the baseball stadium peopled entirely by cardboard cutouts observing a game under a completely grayed out orangish sky. And right now, if I take a peek through my curtains,
I'm looking for images.
Yeah, Vancouver Island is not doing much better, although it's not orange here, it's just gray.
Yeah,
I have not been able to go outside to go running anytime within the past week, but fortunately, I did get out on an adventure in time before the smoke really blew in.
Yes, so, you were going to update us on what happened last week, or because you mentioned last week about an adventure. Is that this?
Yes, that's this.
Oh, so, okay.
This time, on this past Sunday, which would have been Sunday the 6th of September, 2020, I met up with some folks I met over the internet with the intent of going up to the Lenora Copper Mine site on Mount Sicker in the general area of the northern end of the Cowichan Valley. I mentioned last week about the industrial history of that region, but we never got to see any of it because the road to the copper mine was gated off because of it being forest fire season, and they don't want anything with a combustion engine going up there, despite the fact that at the time it was remarkably damp.
And what's it like now?
Well, I haven't been back there in the time since then, but at the time it was remarkably damp. So instead of going up to the Lenora Copper Mine, we circled around the mountain to the Chemainus River Provincial Park, and we went for a walk down there by the river, and we ended up finding just a ton, well, not a ton, but about 10 pounds of chanterelle mushrooms, which was...
What are these?
Well, they're mushrooms, James.
Well, yes, but I mean, what is about them is special. Can you eat them? Are they interesting? I mean, do they look cool? I mean, they glow in the dark? Are they psychedelic? You know?
For those of you who don't know what a chanterelle mushroom is, it's just a tasty type of edible mushroom. And the site that we found them on was actually closer to the Lenora copper mine than the trailhead that we couldn't get up. So we went all the way around Mount Sicker and started approaching the Lenora copper mine from the other end, although the trail we were on did not join up to the trail of the Lenora copper mine. But what was interesting about it is that the area where we found all these mushrooms was very mossy, and I think most of the trees there were... let's see here. They were some sort of conifer, but they were not like the big Douglas firs that you would think of as characteristic of this area. These were all relatively young trees, and what I realized while we were hunting the mushrooms is that if you turned over any one of the moss-covered logs or any part of the moss-covered ground cover, is that about the first 5 inches of soil immediately under any part of the mossy surface was all charcoal. This was the site of a long-ago forest fire, which is interesting to me because given the proximity to the Lenora copper mine, the Lenora copper mine was first discovered, well, the site for it was first discovered as a result of a forest fire a little more than 100 years ago. So it was interesting to me that we found all these mushrooms on that particular site, because it was possible that even though we didn't get anywhere near the mine itself, we nonetheless saw the remnants of the event that led to its founding.
Interesting.
So yeah, I don't know anyone who could say for certain whether the masses of charcoal we found in and around the place we were hunting mushrooms was from the same forest fire, but given the proximity and the context and the amount of greenery that had grown over all of the charcoal, it would not surprise me that that was the case.
Certainly sounds like an adventure.
It definitely was, and I look forward to the sky being clear again so that I can go outside and have more of them.
Yes, I think I should, or rather, I think we should at this point say a few words about the concept of adventure, because the Mars Ready Now manifesto basically has three pillars. We've already discussed one of them briefly, which is personal finance. And another one, fitness, even less briefly. But we haven't really talked about this third pillar much. So why don't you say a few words?
Right. So the essence of what we're getting at here is that space is big. It's a really big place. And the transit times from here to anywhere worthwhile are probably longer than most people appreciate. I don't recall what the exact timetable for the manned Apollo missions was, but they're a lot longer than I thought when I was first hearing about them as a child. It's not a nip up to the moon for a day and be back in time for dinner sort of thing. And that's even less the case for interplanetary missions to Mars, which will... I believe we've discussed here, be spending in excess of 6 months in transit.
Seven, yeah.
So the...
I'm trying to find out what the lunar thing was.
Is that anybody who wants to participate in any meaningful, long-ranged manned space program is going to have the mental fortitude to undertake that sort of a journey in confined quarters with little personal space and with the constant threat of imminent death by misadventure looming over your head in the event of some freak accident.
I would say, yeah, that I would say it breaks up. The spirit of adventure breaks up into two parts. You've got the how do I put it? You've got what you just described there, which is the capability to do the thing when you are doing the thing. But you've also got this even lesser, not even lesser. You've just got a lesser form of spirit of adventure, which says that knowing all that you are going to be put through, you are still actually willing to do it or even to try it. Because obviously you can prepare yourself for a mission to space. And it doesn't have to be to Mars. It could be a much shorter jaunt around the moon, which I believe would take about 8 days. It could be even as short as doing a suborbital spaceflight on Virgin Galactic, right? Although that's really short. We're talking a few minutes in space there.
Right.
Or it could be much longer, where it's a trip around the Earth in orbit, or to the International Space Station, or to some kind of new commercial space station that is set up at some point that we don't know about. The point is that even the shortest space-based mission requires a certain amount of testicular fortitude, shall we say, because we all know that space is dangerous and the risks are there. Well, technically, I don't think space is as dangerous as climbing Mount Everest. I think Mount Everest has got a higher body count.
That's because they just let any Yahoo with the budget to do it go up Mount Everest. Space until now has been a very tightly controlled enterprise under the supervision of the smartest people that could be persuaded to do government work.
Yes.
Which my contempt for overpriced government work notwithstanding is nothing to sneeze at. These were genuinely intelligent people working on some of the biggest projects of their generations, and
incredibly amazing. What they achieve is incredible. Yeah. I mean, and there is simply
the scope of mental effort involved is no laughing matter, and the people who have undertaken it are rightly called heroes. So my flippant dismissal of the government and everything it does get in the way of your appreciation for what goes into something like space travel, and certainly appreciate the scale of difference between what has been achieved up there and the uncountable yahoos who got themselves killed trying to climb Everest for the photo op.
Yes. I think there is a certain amount of truth to this. No doubt about it. My thinking is that there are two forms of spirit of adventure. There is the spirit of adventure, which allows you to keep going when you are up there and that you absolutely have to have. And then there is the spirit of adventure that you have to have down here that says, yes, I'm actually willing to do it. There is a slight difference between those two things, because in space, at least, there's not really that much of a choice. I mean, at least when you sign up to do something like Everest, there is a point of no return for Everest, but it's pretty high up. The point of no return when you are doing a space flight is the moment that the candle gets lit underneath the rocket. And at that point, you can't really come back, even if you want to, even if you like really, really want to, you still can't really come back. So at some level, there is a meshing of the two. But my feeling is, and my thought is that, yes, you can develop the personal finances so that you are ready to go to space, so that you can afford to go to space. Yes, you can develop the physical fitness so that you are physically fit and capable to go to space and undergo the physical rigors of go to space. It also behooves you, if you have the ambition to go to space, if you strive to fulfill this sort of heroic explorer ideal, or whatever ideal it is that you picture yourself as that leads you to want to go to space, whether it's the heroic explorer ideal or any other ideal for that matter, and take into account the mental aspect and the mental fortitude aspect, you need to cultivate a spirit of adventure. And my thought, and your thought, Soren, as far as I can tell, our thought, there we go, about this is that Just like you train your mind, and just like you work for your wallet, you also need to develop your spirit of adventure. And so we have been for a few months now, and will continue on in the coming months, to go out on adventures as much as we can in order to develop the spirit of adventure. And we've talked about all sorts of things, haven't we?
Yes. So I'm still a bit financially short of being able to undertake the scuba training, but we're getting there. And as a matter of fact, part of the reason we are cutting things short this week is because I have some casual labor to go and do this afternoon.
Ah, very nice. Everyone we approve of casual labor.
Yep. So that will be today, and I'll be picking up work of that kind as and when I can. And with a bit of luck, I will have enough leads in that field to get enough work to actually make headway on the learning to scuba dive front sometime while we're still doing these podcasts.
Very nice. I've been looking into the possibility of leaving the country.
Ah, yes.
I've been tracking this for quite a while.
You had mentioned.
Yes. Cyprus, for those of you not living in 2020, or those of you who aren't familiar with this part of the world, has done reasonably well in regards to COVID-19. We had a brief epidemic in March, which fed into April. We were on a hockey curve trajectory, and the government saw what happened in Italy and in Spain, and they reacted very quickly, all things considered, very decisively. And they introduced a whole lot of incredibly draconian measures, but the draconian measures worked. So we had things like, for example, everyone was quarantined to their houses by law, and you couldn't go out. And you could only go out for a certain number of times per day, which at the beginning was limited to one. And this was the vast majority of the time that the quarantine was instigated. And if you wanted to go out, it had to be for an approved purpose, of which there were six, I think, or it may have been eight. Six or eight purposes. And you had to write out a form and send an SMS to the government with a code saying what your ID number was, where you were living, and what the purpose was that you were going out for by 1 to 8. So I'm going out for, food and essential supplies. Purpose number 3, send off to the government. And then an automated response comes back, provided that you are, being a good boy or girl and are within the regulations, saying, yep, you can leave now. You can go out, but you must be back within 30 minutes or half an hour or 2 hours or whatever it is they felt like giving you at that particular time. And so very draconian, obviously, but it worked. And we are currently riding steady in single digits. We had a bit of a flare up about a week ago. It was looking dicey. It looked like we might be in for another epidemic, but we managed to get things under control. And so Cyprus, in regards to the club of countries that are looking at each other, that are sizing each other up and saying, could we let these guys, travel between us? Cyprus is on the list of countries that is probably going to be among the first, hopefully, fingers crossed, that might be allowed to travel again. And this is my hope. I would like that very much to be the case.
And hey, maybe if that is the case, I'll finally be able to mail you your birthday present.
You still can't do that.
Not as of the last time I checked.
Wow. You see, I'm getting a delivery from the United States, I believe. So might actually be up again.
Okay, well, I'll have to go and bother the people at the Canada Post.
Yeah. I don't have many other updates apart from that. I'm looking forward to traveling again. I would like to travel again. I've got some ideas about what I'd like to do while traveling. Hang on a minute. My screen just went blank. Yeah, I've got some ideas about what I'd like to do while traveling, but that's for another episode, I think. I don't really have much else to talk about apart from a small update that I'm working on Turkish get-ups for my kettlebells. As has been pointed out, yes, James, kettlebells don't work in space. we know this. But
we actually comment that?
Aye. Yeah, we did. Oh, anyway.
It was us. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But nevertheless. So yeah, I think that's all we've got for you today. So, and on that note, I think it's going to be goodbye from me, James Coombs.
And it's goodbye from me, Soren Childs.
And remember, prepare now, because the future is sooner than you think. The journey continues. Thank you for listening. Thank you to everyone who supports us. Be sure to subscribe and review. We really appreciate it. And if you're ready to go one step further, head on over to marsreadynow.com to read and commit to the Mars Ready Now Manifesto. To win in space first requires you to win on Earth. Again, that's marsreadynow.com, link in the description.